Folks, this is a little commercial message. You know, we're trying to raise some money to buy a new laptop or a new used laptop for use in our podcasting and maybe another mic. And we also, I found out we needed a kind of a special device to help us record phone calls through the internet. You can just go to the shop page of www.ganglandwire.com and click on the buy button. And it will go to PayPal, and you can either use your credit card or if you have a PayPal account. And for $1.99, I'll then send you the link to these two premium episodes. It will make our lives a lot easier, and we can have a little more professional production. Thank you.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back, everybody. Sitting here with my good friend Aaron, the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 in the beautiful Ice House in beautiful downtown Kansas City with our special guest, retired detective David Starbuck. We're talking about Jamaican drug posses. Now, Aaron, say hello.
Hello, Aaron.
And I want to do a shout out also. I forgot to do that in the one before. I've had some great support from my good friend Barry Parks up in Smithville. I really appreciate your support, Barry. My good friend Greg, we go back and forth every once in a while on email. My good friend Joe from down in Florida that emails with me every once in a while and kind of tells me about some things that he remembers when he was young in Kansas City. And then I got a nice little bit of help from Rick Jones, and Rick Jones got him a Gangland Wire t-shirt. So just remember, if you want to make a donation to help us pay for these Freedom of Information Act requests and help pay for studio time and some other things, some equipment. I had to buy a special little wire for Aaron the other night to do our live remote from over at Stanford's Comedy Club.
Or if you just want to maybe, you know, help us produce this thing.
Right, just doing general day-to-day production stuff. Why?
And, you know, the other thing is, and we never really said this before, but we could, if you'd like us to come out and do a special podcast episode for you. Now, it's not free, but
we'd do it if you pay us. We'll probably pretty much do anything you pay us, right, Aaron?
For the right amount. Now, it might cost a little more if you want somebody like David Starbuck
to come along.
I'm sure he may have a rate as well if he's available in town.
I'll bet he does. Anyhow, so we're back here. Let's get back into it.
In the first episode, we were talking with David Starbuck, who is a retired narcotics detective who served on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department from 1976 to 2001.
And the main reason he's here, I remembered, I had an inquiry from a listener who wanted to know about Jamaican drug posses and Jamaican drug gangs in Kansas City. He remembered that. It was in all the headlines there for a while. And I think they'd made a movie. Wasn't there a movie that was kind of... wasn't very well received. Wasn't there kind of a popular movie about Jamaican drug gangs back in the 90s, maybe?
I suspect so. I don't know if any of them ever touched on the Midwest.
Probably not.
Part of that.
They never do.
That wasn't the one about the bobsledding team.
No. No, it wasn't the bobsledding, the Jamaican bobsled team movie.
We didn't know that was part of the movie. Thought they really loved bobsledding.
Excellent book that was written that really captured it. And this woman, she really did her research, and she's Jamaican. She's out of Florida, named Lori Gunston. It's called Born Fided, and it just really goes into depth about the whole evolvement from the Rastafarian marijuana culture, and then the cocaine and the crack and the violence.
Interesting. And spell that title.
Born, B-O-R-N, F-I, dead.
D-E-A-D. Okay. And what was the author's name?
I believe it's Lori Gunst, G-U-N-S-T.
Okay. Just go to your Amazon.
Excellent book.
Okay. Just go to your Amazon and take a look for that.
So really what we're talking about here is in the 80s, mid-80s, there was a lot of cocaine use, and then the development of what is a concentrated form of cocaine, which was crack cocaine. And the development of these crack houses in and around Kansas City and really other parts of the country that were manned by young 19, 20-year-old Jamaicans.
You know, and you talked about their marketing and the genius marketing of the small rocks. And I had retired detective Jim Harrington on here a couple weeks ago. And he pointed out that another good marketing tool or marketing fact about crack cocaine is when you bought a rock, you knew exactly what you were getting, because once you make it into rock, you can't dilute it. If it's in powder, you don't know exactly what you're getting. It could be 90% baby powder or talcum powder or something, but with a rock, you pretty much know what you're getting. I know there was some fake rock out there. I think they called it soap, but if you got a real rock,
it was soap.
Why did they call it soap? You remember?
Oh, I trust me, myself and my peers, we bought a lot of, they would sell pieces of wax, earwax, soap. They'd make all kinds of stuff to replicate crack. But if you got caught, that was not good for your health.
No, it wasn't. Couldn't get away with it very long.
Now, but the cocaine, they would transport it here, like you said in the episode before. They'd have these basically drug mules or couriers that were also Jamaican, usually women. And they wouldn't come in with these larger 40, 50, you know, kilo loads. It would just be a pound or two, but it'd still be the powder. So once they got it here, they had to condense it down. Right? You know, there's a process there for making it into,
yes,
you know, the rock.
Yes. They would take it to houses where it'd be cooked up and converted and cut up into rocks. And then they'd take the supplies of rocks and distribute them through to the distribution houses all over the metro. And they were also, I said they wanted to cut their losses. They would not leave large supplies of crack in any house at any given time because they knew they were going to get raided. So if they got raided, they wanted to lose a half ounce or an ounce and maybe a few thousand dollars. They didn't. So, and they expected that they were going to lose some of the worker bees and some of the drugs and money, but so it was just constant little small seizures. And then occasionally we'd get luckier and get something large.
So the cookhouses were different from the crack houses, the distribution.
Oh,
houses.
Yeah, because they'll keep the storage and the cook locations. Those will be secretive, and that you have to be higher in the chain, and that would be prepared. And then they would go out, and you'd have people that were the retail distributors. They knew nothing other than this is my house. This is what I do. This guy comes in, gives me $500 worth of crack. He comes back 4 hours later. I give him that money.
Were you ever able to maybe follow somebody, a courier who would bring in a re-up into the house and follow him back and find a distribution house? Or
oh,
a,
yeah.
Well,
and that's as the case evolved over about a year, we identified the principals and then began to identify where they were living and some of the storage facilities. And then just like any other case, identify patterns and we'd see them deliver and then we'd hit a house. And so little by little, and then towards the end, when we had a series of federal search warrants on the hierarchy, then we hit the primary stash houses and got some significant quantities.
And the places where they actually cooked it off. Did they, when they cooked it off, I'm not familiar with crack cocaine in terms of, they must have, much like when they would get it as a powder, cut it in some fashion or add something, some other ingredients or anything else to it to kind of make it into a rock?
They would bring the cocaine in, and whatever consistency it was is probably what it was going to get cooked into, because you don't gain anything by diluting powder cocaine and then making it, because the crack is the base.
Okay.
So you're taking whatever cocaine powder and you're extracting the base, so you don't want any more adulterants in it.
Okay. See, I'm really, since I'm not really into the into that scene.
Since you're not a crackhead.
I'm not a crackhead, or I don't do coke. I didn't always understand, but I understood it was super addictive. And people, you know, you tell people that were crack addicts because they were losing their teeth.
What about the local drug gangs? Was there an incident or a situation where you had any kind of a war between? I'm trying to think in the 80s, even who was. It was the fire captain, Captain Dowdy. Was his operation going then, or was it rolled up by then? They'd always, you know, in Kansas City, you'd get a crack operation going, a cocaine operation going, and it would draw a lot of attention, like the Jamaicans did on themselves finally, and then pretty soon you'd focus on them and you'd roll them up and end up taking them all down, but somebody else would always spring up. So
you had
rolling them up.
Yeah, Kansas City. You had other individuals that were involved in their own drug network things, and they may have a different customer base. The Jamaicans had their own little piece of the pie. They also were masters at recruiting because they would undercut others on the retail. And if others were selling $30 rocks, they'd sell $20 rocks. A lot of the customers, the users that we'd arrest all the time, they wanted the Jamaican dope because the Jamaicans would cut a larger rock. You'd get a little bit more. But it might be the same price, but it was all about marketing. So, and there was some rivalry and there was some violence back and forth. The Jamaican problem with the crack really escalated. Their heyday was from about 86 to early 88. And then Kansas City got known nationally as not a good place for Jamaican drug traffickers.
Thanks to you.
Thanks to a lot of great cops.
And you said here earlier you went on 300 crack house raids.
Oh, at least.
How long would you spend just surveilling the house, go through, do a buy, before you would assemble really your team? Because you had to, it wasn't just, you know, it's a process there.
First you have to make a buy. Now, would they just make a cold call in there and then make a buy? Or did you have to use another crackhead to go in and make a controlled buy, which means they went in, bought it, and brought it back to your...
It was in its heyday and there were so many spots, a lot of times any stranger could walk up to the door and knock on it. All it took was... And we had an incredible array of great undercovers, and we could see the pattern of, okay, they seem to be a lot of white teenage users. You know, we could put anything in there. Sometimes you go up and knock and they wouldn't like the looks on you, they'd turn you away, but you could send another person right after that. So sometimes we would get daily updates on, here's a new house that they've, and we'd do a little surveillance. They'd say, yep, it's rolling. You could send an undercover up there. He or she'd make a buy. They'd leave. They'd do a quick test, go right down, apply for a search warrant. While they're applying, they'd be gathering up the tactical teams and then the squads of detectives. And I would usually go out there as part of the search team and process. And you could have it...
An hour?
Well, you could have it kicked in sometimes within 2 or 3 hours.
And then when you guys came in, I mean, these were houses in neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming, or apartments, or an apartment in a building.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you're bringing all these officers in to basically, you know, break. You know, when you serve the warrant, do you knock on the door and go, hey, it's the police, we've got a warrant? Or do you kick the door down, go in, and make sure everybody's on the ground?
You would apply for certain conditions. Now, if there's
guns in the, you know, you say there were guns.
Always were guns. There was always a propensity for violence. It was very uncommon, and a lot of those undercover officers would go in there, and they would do it to everybody. They'd walk in, and you're standing there, and they'd put two guns to your head. They're just trying to bluff you, see, you know, are you a cop? And you talk about being a master at talking your way out of that stuff. So, yeah, a lot of times we'd have a no-knock provision where officers went up. There was no knocking for safety of all concern. They just rammed it and went in.
That's what they call it, a no-knock provision.
Yes.
Confusion. aggravation, aggravation, resistance, yes.
By that time, we had such a pattern, and we usually could establish who was in there and what the patterns were, and that we have now served 75 search warrants related to this organization, and in 75 of them, there have been large caliber weapons. There have been people that attempted to assault police, and so it was usually not too difficult.
They don't necessarily just go down quietly. They try to run away, or they
Yeah, they jump. Yeah, the tactical guys, they make the entry, and while they're doing that, usually you'll have the other squads. You would do the perimeter because you're watching people become diving out of windows. So then you're doing foot chases in about six different directions, and just the whole neighborhood. It's a family event.
How many people would be in that tactical team that went in through the front door, if you will?
The standard tactical team would be from 6 to 8, and sometimes they would double up depending on what was being described as the size, or if there was any real logistics. And sometimes you'd want some extra bodies there because you anticipated problems.
And Gary, you were in tactical, weren't you?
I was. I served a few of these.
You served. You went through the breach.
Sure. And once more into the breach, boys. Yeah, and how that works is there's usually six officers and a sergeant, so that's seven people. And if you were had somebody off that day, would go to another tac squad and borrow somebody, because you train for these all the time. You train exactly the same way and have exactly the same people doing exactly the same job. And so you had your point man, and the point person was always the first one through the door. And then the next guy behind the point person would usually have a shotgun. And it would always be a big, strong guy. And the second person back would be even a bigger, stronger guy many times. And then the sergeant would be number four. And then there would be one more behind the sergeant. And then I would send the two other officers to watch the back door. And if it was just us serving it. Now, if you had to, I think they changed that later on. We always, usually they kept the plainclothes people away, best I remember. Now, we had a few times where people came up, but...
Or like David said, they would maybe, kind of help perimeter?
Be around the perimeter, but,
well,
but kind of back.
They kept... Undercovers never went there.
Undercovers never went there, right.
We would be called the enforcement squad. We were going to be... The tech guys, their role was to go in, secure it, get everybody laid out, handcuffed, and then they'd turn it over to us, and we'd walk in, decide, he goes to jail. We'd search houses, go down, do the interviews, take it wherever it was going. The tag guys would usually be on the way to go kick in another one a few blocks away. It was a volume business then.
Yeah, those guys in that particular operation, I remember they just go from one to the other to the other. I don't think it ever happened before or after quite like that.
So you'd really be rolling like multiple tactical units and detectives as you would, because you wanted to make these busts as rapidly as you could, not just because there were so many, but that word would certainly get out on the street when a house went down.
Oh, yeah. And then the next day we'd come in and inform, and so they'd say, okay, here's six new spots they opened up overnight, and that's how it was.
Here's what we did one time. We knew of several other houses, but they didn't have probable cause for warrants on these other houses, but they knew we were after. So I don't remember who was in charge of narcotics at the time, so he had to, there's about six different, all the tax squads in the city, I think. Was there six? No, there was one, two, yeah, four. There were six. Now, there were six squads, but I think we had at least five of them that day, and we hit five houses, but they had four or five more houses that they knew were out there, and they didn't have a probable cause for. So whoever the commander was said, now, here's what I want you guys to do. I want you to, I think they were trying to tickle a wire also. He said, I want you guys to go flying up that house like you're going to serve a search warrant.
Yep.
And go up and just bang on the door and surround the house, but don't do anything. You can't go in. Don't do anything else. And I think what they were trying to do was tickle the wire. They had a wire up somewhere, so they trying to stir more conversation on the telephone.
We'd do that, and you could hear the water pressure in the whole block go down. Everybody in the block is flushing stuff.
Plus, yeah, they dumped
they
a lot of dope.
Tickling the wire.
Yeah,
tickling the wire.
They'd be listening with a wiretap and wait for the calls.
Right, just see, if they're on it, and then they can see what they said.
Well, and that was the other thing. We had wires up on this case. And we would hit houses, and then they'd say, okay, all right, so-and-so is upset about this, and so it got to a point where it was just, we were just playing with them.
Well, to the degree that you had those kind of surveillance in place and you were following them and you were really working your way up from, you know, just the individual house, if you will, selling the crack cocaine to more where they stored it and where they manufactured it. And I mean, that didn't happen overnight.
No, and the other big challenge is because they're so transient. So they, one of them would be here for a week and then we wouldn't see him. Then we'd get a call in Miami and say, well, no, he's down here now. And then they'd bring six new faces up and we're trying to sort them out, you know, figure out who is this guy, what's his role in the big picture. And it was a chess game.
Was it the kind of organization as you, of course, it was kind of on down the road when you start taking off people who really were important in Kansas City, but was it kind of an organization if you took off somebody important in Kansas City that somebody else would just come in and fill their spot?
Oh, yeah. And you had a lot of them that we'd get calls at whatever happened to so-and-so, and they'd find him murdered down in Kingston, and then, or he or she'd end up in New York. So it was just constantly trying to track them. And, And then when it came to the roundup of the 12 or 10 top ones that we did, it was a nightmare. They were all over the world trying to track them down.
And you're really trying to execute that pretty simultaneously?
Yes. They,
for the same reasons.
I worked with an ATF agent, Dwayne Nichols, and he wrote, I helped him, but he wrote, I can't remember, it was like a 300-page federal search warrant affidavit, and it was phenomenal. I never saw anybody write that much, and it outlined every house and all his connections to all over the world, and it was fun.
David, you should get that and write a book about this. It's a lot of work writing a book. I'm in the middle of trying to do one now. It's a ton of work. And I was first talking to David Barton. I said, well, we ought to do a documentary on this Jamaican drug gang, and he's all for it, and I can see you would be too, but you're not all for doing all the work. It's a ton of work.
Knowing something like that you might be able to, you know, the part of the secret is knowing the questions to ask.
Yeah.
Doing a Freedom Information Act request to be able to kind of narrow it down to something very specific.
We could probably get hold of DR and get that.
I want to be the guy that's on the cover of the book. It says, by Gary Jenkins with Dave Starbuck. I want to be the with guy.
You want to be the with guy. That's like our friend.
On the spine.
You're on the spine.
That's really when they put it on the shelf. The photo on the spine is what everybody sees.
Well, we talked at break about reggae music and the connection of reggae music, which got him. I remember this. My wife at the time got to be a big reggae fan. And that's how I knew about through her and some of her friends that how everybody thought it was that it was really great weed they were bringing back from
Jamaica.
Jamaica, yeah. So what was kind of the connection? I mean, that I know there was something going on.
Well, the music and the reggae is just part of the whole Caribbean culture. And I know Bob Marley died, I believe, in 1980. But I would talk to so many of these Jamaican drug suspects, and he was still, he's a god. But then there was a lot of crossover because a lot of them were fledgling reggae. A lot of them had, they had some recording
equipment
studios in Kansas City, and they produced, because I've got some of their albums, some of the local guys.
Using the drug money that invested in
I don't think they got a bank loan, but I suspect there might have been some.
It's kind of like the hip hop culture today. There's a lot of local.
So the music also it was endemic in part of it, but it had gotten a very dark side because it was no more the old Jimmy Buffett.
No woman, no cry.
This isn't about smoking some ganja anymore.
Yeah, this escalated and it was a whole different culture. So yeah, it was always part of it. A lot of them had nothing to do with it, but the music was always very important. And it was something I'd always talk about. I mean, I love Marley still. And we would actually, we would always play a Marley beat right before we'd go out and do a raid.
On your way to the search warrant.
Oh, yeah. Everybody get pumped up.
This was pre-Bad Boys.
Yeah, Bad Boys, Bad Boys, yeah.
And I mean, when you talk about that, I mean, so they were like bringing in a kilo. You said a kilo is about 2.2 pounds. Cost for that kilo at the time, $25,000 to $35,000. That's a large amount of money just to come up with. And as you just said, you're not getting a bank loan for it. So, I mean, how did they bankroll just to get that?
Well, it's like anything. You know, you start out on a small scale. A lot of them probably initially made some of their money just by basic marijuana trafficking, and that was big. A lot of them had connections, and there were people in Florida. Some of our primaries, they were well established in southern Florida, so you know they were in the mix. And marijuana was still a money maker, but then the cocaine was coming in. Everybody wanted a piece of that. Everybody in Miami was getting into the powder cocaine industry, and then the Jamaicans and would be the suppliers of that. And they started seeking out cities across the country. And some cities they weren't a good mix. Kansas City, for whatever reason, they hit a little opening and it flourished. They never caught on in St. Louis. Some of our Jamaican characters went down there and tried a feeble attempt to get into the crack market in St. Louis, and they didn't play well with the crack dealers down there. It just didn't work.
Was that because there was maybe already existing gangs with the Crips and the Bloods, or
that wasn't Crips and Bloods? It was just local crack dealers that said, no, this is ours, and you know, we don't want Rasta Man in here, you know. So they didn't get a good, it was just the chemistry, whatever worked, and they made the right connections here. And I think because we had there were three or four old, well-established Jamaican families here, and they were kind of a conduit, and they gave them some connections and some advice.
Plus, they brought crack in for the first time, too. And before we had the heroin gangs, like the old Black Mafia and the Kelton Brothers and June Bug Gant and trying to think of some of those other, Monk Johnson and Red Strong. Those are all the old heroin people. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of on their way out at that time.
Sam Haley,
yeah. And they were all on their way out at that time. So they might have actually just got here at an opportune time when there was a little bit of a vacuum.
It was. And I know when I came out of the police academy in 77, I worked the midnight shift down in Wayne Minor Projects, and heroin was running rampant. That was the tail end of that crew. But then there was a big, you didn't see heroin around here for a long time, even years later. And it was primarily the drug of choice. It was an old school.
The older
drug.
People, right.
And then crack, and that was it. And now heroin has just come back with a savage new twist on it. But now this is all Mexican cartel supplied. So.
Right. And that's my next question, actually. I was just kind of formulating this in my mind, David. The lines of supply, shall we say, to use a military term, lines of supply in Kansas City, you know, I'm not sure where heroin came from. It was kind of before my time. But the cocaine kind of came up out of Miami, but they really created a stream of cocaine coming up out of South America into the West Indies somewhere, transit points down there with dealing with Colombians, and then brought it to Miami, and then it came on up in the United States, whereas it's changed now. It's all coming out of the Southwest and Texas, and Mexican cartels pretty well control it, I would say now.
Well, because law enforcement's put such a crimp on it. A lot of it still comes up through the southern Florida and through the islands, but there's so much enforcement there. The cartels in Colombia learned it was more cost effective, so a lot now just goes right up through Central America. And it goes to the Mexican cartels. Then they take it from there. So they now control everything.
This is before those Colombians developed those submersible boats. Have you seen those?
Yep.
No matter what law enforcement did over the last 20 or 30 years, those Colombians would come up with some different twist that there's no way to stop it. And then you get to Mexico and they've dug all those tunnels. I firmly believe there's no way to stop it. That just no matter what you do, it's a whack-a-mole.
Supply and demand.
As long as there's a demand, it's going to come.
I've got a lot to say. Slow down. slow down. I know what you're moving in every way.
You know, Joe Citizen out here on a traffic stop, and they find him with some crack. So they're sitting in jail, and we go down to a... Yeah, you go interview them. Okay, it's a possession case, but you're also interviewing them. That was a big source of information. Like, you know, I don't really care about you. You've got a problem. You need help. But where are you getting this from? Man, you'd start, you'd get it. Then they'd identify houses and stuff. So that was a, but, oh, it was just devastating. More and more people that, you know, are never had any criminal history, never had any problem, and they hit that pipe, and they were stone cold into it, and it just devastated families, jobs, futures. I will, though, having worked drugs so many years, my personal opinion, yeah, crack is devastating, but I've seen many people get over crack addiction successfully. The one that scares me much more and much less rate of overcoming it is the methamphetamine problem. Meth is just twice as devastating to me. The crack's still there. There's still a user base. It's a big problem. But meth also, because it's locally produced, and people could, you know, I could go to Walgreens to get what I need and go make myself a little bit. And so it presents so many problems. And yeah, it's devastating. All of them are devastating.
It's kind of what, to me, it seems like it's whatever the press pays attention to, you know. Mm-hmm. At one time it was heroin, of course, and that's kind of what we had. Then it was cocaine, then it was crack, and then it was heroin, and in between there, it was, and all through this is marijuana, and then there's prescription drugs, and that's kind of a big one today. That's kind of taken a forefront in the media today, is all these kids are stealing drugs for, you know, Percocet or whatever from their parents' medicine cabinets, and so that seems to be a big problem.
And the thing that's huge right now is you see this incredible upswing in the renewal of heroin. The biggest majority of heroin abusers right now, if you look at their background, they are people who began it because they became addicted to prescription opiates.
Yeah, started on Dilaudid or something like that.
Yeah, so they do those, and now it's easier for them to just buy heroin, and the Mexican cartels know that. They know they have a big user base, so now they're flooding the zone with high-grade Mexican heroin.
Mm. You know, and opioid use is so prevalent in this country that they even have a commercial. I couldn't believe this. They have a commercial for a laxative for opioid induced constipation. I think I said that right. But it's like, oh my God, there's a nationally produced commercial that's on primetime TV, mm-hmm, for a laxity for people who take too many opiates and so too many painkillers. I don't know, we're kind of a drug addicted country. It seems like sometimes I don't like to be
they're not saying, they're saying, you know,
Danny Downer, but
for the just the, you know, the heroin addict who's shooting up at home or whatever.
you got so many people that are taking so many painkillers that they develop a special laxative.
Just for them.
I don't know. I don't get it.
Now, you mentioned some of these guys, some of these Jamaicans by name, or I should say their pseudonym.
Yes.
How did you get back to their names? Yeah. Like from, what was the guy's name? You said it, Darren.
I had Dogbite and Fatty Priest were two of the names I wrote down.
Well, we learned early on in Jamaican culture and a lot of West Indian cultures, everybody's known by their street name. It's just a pet name. Most of them had it since they were kids. Some of it's related to maybe their attitude. But no, we would keep hearing these, and then we would get surveillance pictures of people. We'd get people that were kind of quasi trying to inform, and little by little, and they'd say, here's a picture of some guy in a car. That's him. That's Fatty Priest. Okay, so we know this is Fatty Priest. So then eventually sometime we'd spot the guy getting groceries or something, so we'd stop him just to identify him. But even that was difficult.
They may have a fake ID.
Because they would have phony, yeah, IDs, and trying to confirm anything with identities or birth records out of Jamaica was challenging.
At best.
Yeah.
these that you've been, when you incarcerated them, because you arrested, let's say, in a raid at a crack house, and they weren't citizens. They were really illegal aliens under
right.
a visa they had broke. And would you turn them over to immigration naturalization, or would you end up incarcerating them and filling up the jails
the,
here?
The biggest majority of these, we would file them in federal court, and we had it down to a well-oiled machine. We would literally hit the house, arrest them. We had an ATF agent or two that would come with us. They would immediately start looking at the guns, trace the guns, and we have immigration agents. We'd talk to them. They would make a determination. And then when you would file, you walk them into federal court and do a complaint. We're filing this. There is no bond because we'd say he's charged with selling crack cocaine and there's a presence of a firearm. You'd have ATF say it's a stolen firearm out of Miami, and then immigration say, I've determined this man is in the country illegally. The judge say, there's no bond. You're held, no bond. They never got out. And it was so incredible. There was, you know, they call themselves posses, the Waterhouse Posse, the Jungle Posse. We went out, we arrested this one particular Jamaican trafficker who was pretty notorious. And while we were there processing this house, his elderly aunt came over, and she was a nice old Jamaican lady, and I was trying to explain to her, we've taken him away, and he's and she said, I know you put him in that black hole, because the Kansas City Star had put an article out that week. It said, Kansas City, a black hole to Jamaican that. Drug traffickers.
I remember that
and
headline.
And it got out, and they said, oh, they're putting them in a black hole.
When was that? Do you remember?
That was 86, 87. I have the article. And she said that. Well, we were in Miami a few weeks later, and I went to a kiosk. I brought them back. I gave one to the attorneys and everybody. We made ourselves, we were the black hole posse.
Black hole posse.
I still have my black hole posse coffee mug. And, oh yeah, it said, Kansas City, a black hole to Jamaican traffickers. And then we would get calls from cops in New York. I mean, the word is, hey, there's some black hole posse. Who are these guys? I said, they're the baddest. Okay? So we rode that notoriety as long as we could.
All right, let's wind this on down. I think we will come back with David's former commander. His name is David, also David Martin. I'm going to go meet with him tomorrow and talk a little bit about what we talked about tonight. I haven't seen David for quite a while. Be good to see him again. He's a guy that when I first went to the tech unit, I knew he had just left a tech squad, and I was like going to be a new sergeant there. And I stopped up at Central Patrol. He was the brand new captain, and I sat down and I said, you know, tell me about this. What would that be like? And he gave me this one piece of advice that it was great. He said, you make those guys, you have six guys that work for you. He said, they want to all dress like different, like Mexican generals and have bandoliers and, you know, eye patches and stuff. He said, you make those guys dress in their uniforms, whether it be their tactical uniform or their regular uniform, unless you're doing something that's undercover. But particularly if you're training, when you go out to practice doing these search warrants and making entries and all that, you make them wear that SWAT outfit, that blue SWAT outfit, and wear all the proper equipment and keep them working, and you'll never have any trouble. And, you know, he was right, because first thing I had, they all wanted to dress different, and especially when they went out to practice, they wanted to all have their own twist on their clothes. So I cracked on them like that.
You want me to tell one quick David Barton story?
That'll be, there's a lot of them.
And
but
just, he, I mean,
David Barton, he's the,
he's not going to be our next guest about the Jamaican.
He,
yes.
I mean, he had us running and gunning, and I mean, we were like in the winter, and we followed a couple of Jamaican guys that we thought were heavy players, and they head up, and we end up at the airport. We get up there, and I call. You don't have cell phones. I'm calling from payphone. I said, they both just booked a flight. They're getting ready to fly to Miami. And this was real significant. I can't remember why. And he said, get on that plane. What do you mean get on that plane?
He would do that.
So we go over and plop down a credit card and buy a couple of obnoxious tickets to Miami. We have no luggage, nothing. And we just get on the plane. And by the time we call, we get off with parkas on, and it's about 80 degrees down there. Miami is already waiting for us, and we get off. And
didn't you have your sidearm with you?
Yeah, in those days, all you had to do, you could get on. You just had to fill out a quick form and get on. So those were the days.
Those were the
just
days.
A quick form, show them a badge.
Yeah, yeah. They wouldn't do that today, I promise you that.
No, but it'd be a cavity search now.
Yes.
And you flew down there, and what happened?
By the time we got there, he'd already arranged, and we got off, and we got off, and we spotted a couple of guys we knew. They already had a surveillance team, and we followed these guys out, and we're pointing to them, it's those two, and then we assimilate into that. We're down there for a week. I said, we don't have any clothes. Buy some clothes.
Yeah. He was, I tell you what, I like working for that guy. He was tough. He was tough. And you didn't want to be a dog ass and work for him.
No.
You did not last long. But he would get the job done, and I always appreciated that in a commander. All right. I think we've probably done it for these two segments. Let me give my little public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative or a coworker who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. And if you're from outside of Kansas City, go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org.
Good night. Thanks for having me.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Check them out at oddomaticmusic.com.